Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, it's just you and me this morning. No Ronald. He indicated that he's at a three-hour meeting from 9 to 12 his time. It sounds suspiciously like a grad school thing. I feel like only in academia would you meet for 3 hours and expect people to pay attention and be engaged. So shout out to Ronald.
Or like Reformed conferences.
That's true.
Because I'm pretty sure, I mean, may it rest in peace forever and ever, amen. But I'm pretty sure the sermons at T4G were about 3 hours long.
I think so. Which flouts any and all rules of like human communication and decency. They're like, studies have shown people can only pay attention for 30 to 45 minutes, so we'll make our sermon 3 hours.
There's an interesting like juxtaposition between the preponderance of tweed and the lack of human communication skills. Mm-hmm. And Reformed conferences in academia, heavy on the tweed.
So much tweed.
Light on the decent communication skills.
Yeah, that's so true. So much tweed, so many meetings, and they're so long. Pipe, I want to take a break. Actually, I don't want to. We're going to because we have to, as per our contract with the nameless, faceless corporate entities that we're dealing with. But after the break, I want to come back. I want to talk about this dynamic that you observed in me, wherein I talk a lot of crap about things that I've been involved with for a long time and also kind of love. We'll be back.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Piper, we're back. We're going to talk about publishing today because there's been some interesting news in the publishing industry. We're going to talk about self-promotion, etc. But you pointed out something fascinating on the air, which was I make fun of academia despite loving my job. And I really make fun of publishing despite enjoying writing books and publishing them. This was a fascinating observation. I'd never quite put those two things together. Do you have anything more to add or say about that?
Well, I mostly just kind of wanted to peel the layers of your psyche back to kind of figure this out, because, you know, there are certain things you love and are devoted to that you don't make fun of. Like, you don't, right. You know, when your family comes up on here, you speak with great affection, as mm-hmm. as exactly as we would hope you would. When your church yeah. comes up, like, you'll yeah. make fun of the church, which I think kind right. of falls in this category because you've been part of the church for, you know, ever. But not your church, because, again, it kind of falls into the family category in terms of devotion and seriousness. But, yeah, academia and publishing and then maybe the broader church, you love them. Mm-hmm. And you talk so much crap about them. Like, if somebody, we could pull so many sound bites, and we could basically be like, Ted hates all publishers.
Yeah.
While
yeah.
in fact, you keep going back to them to put out books, like with significant regularity.
Yeah. It's a weird dynamic, isn't it? And it's one of those things where, like, I think when you've been with something for so long, right? So, like, publishing, I'm going on 20 years with that now, in some form or fashion, almost 20 years with books. Like, I've done it. I've been around the block enough. You see all the things that are good, but you also see all the things that are super dumb. And I think the internet has made it worse. I think it's less cool to be an author now than it was 20 years ago. And really, like, you know, Twitter and Instagram and self-promotion has made it less cool, which we'll get into because we want to talk about that. But yeah, I see all the stupid things about it and all the stupid books that still get greenlit and published. And I feel a certain, and hear me out on this, and I want to hear you on this. I almost feel, Pipe, a certain like moral obligation to make fun of it. Because as everybody's tweeting the stupid pictures of their stupid next books that don't need to be written and that are going to sell like 900 copies, I feel a certain moral obligation, and I include my books in that like spectrum, right? I'm not saying that my books are any different, but I feel a certain moral obligation to every once in a while be like, hey, this is really dumb. Like, in case you've forgotten, this is ridiculous. Where are you at on that? Do you feel some of the same kind of urges in that space?
To a degree. This podcast is sort of my outlet for most of that.
Yeah.
In the sense of most of what we've done for the last 8 years is make fun of things that we mostly love or things adjacent to what we love, sort of the dumb stuff about what we love.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know that I would call it a moral obligation. I think what it is, and I noticed this from you specifically when it comes to academia, it's the mindset of, we're still doing this, like this, this again, like, I thought we were going to grow and improve. And instead we're running this same dumb idea back again. And I see some of that in publishing where you're like, really, we needed another book on this, or we're doing the launch team thing again, or, you know, pick your favorite, you know, whatever the thing is.
Your favorite non-working marketing strategy.
Yeah.
Do that again.
Like we've talked about, the only good marketing strategy is being famous already. So
yes, that's right.
It's the one that works.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is a sense in which it's like, this is dumb, but also when you're part of it, there's also, to play the game, you have to play the game, like by certain rules.
Yeah.
We have to play by certain marketing rules, even if we are 100% sure they're not going to work very well.
Like today, for example, I'm gonna be cranky about a thing that's happening this afternoon.
Wonderful, go for it.
This podcast that I'm guesting on this afternoon to promote our new book, which if you haven't picked up a copy yet, run to amazon.com, type in Happy Rant book, and purchase yourself a copy. But I'm guesting on this podcast this afternoon, Pipe, and I know you've done these, and I don't think Ronald has done any of them. He'll be up next time. But I know that it's not going to move the needle at all, but I'm saying yes to doing it in part because it's part of playing the game, right? And you have to say yes. And what was hilarious about it was that the publicist was like, yeah, they'll need about an hour and a half of your time. And I'm like, an hour and a half for a podcast?
Is this Joe Rogan's podcast? What are we doing here?
Exactly. Like, if it's Oprah Winfrey or Joe Rogan or Pat McAfee, the answer is yes. For everyone else, the answer is no way they're getting 90 minutes of my time in the middle of the day. But to your point, it's just how the game is played, and it's ridiculous and it's stupid, but we say yes to what we can say yes to. I think, Pipe, I've identified it, and I've identified the energy in both academia and publishing that I like making fun of. So both of those realms of life are realms of life that have a super high quotient of dudes with no talent who also take themselves super seriously.
Yes,
and I will always want to make fun of that
dude. Part. That's the That's the thing.
Yes, absolutely. Dudes that are utterly convinced of their own like monumental talent or virtue, and who want to bloviate about it. I'm just like, I will always make fun of that. Like I'll be on my deathbed making fun of that, probably to my detriment. And I wonder. And this is a moment for you to maybe put your pastoral hat on a little bit. I wonder if I'll ever feel convicted about this, because I do feel convicted about things. Like, I hope.
You're actually the only one on this podcast who has ever reached out after recording to say, hey, can we cut something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm capable of feeling convicted. But I feel at this moment like no conviction on making fun of academia or publishing. Because I think anywhere where there's that many self-important people, again, it's almost a moral obligation. Like, hey, I have to make fun of this. You know, I got to do it. But I don't know, man.
I don't know that you, like, you should feel conviction over doing something that is harmful or hurtful or tearing down. But you're not, if you went after an academic, you know, right. All of a sudden this is a personal thing. If you're talking about an industry, aren't we sort of, I mean, that's where there is sort of a moral obligation to be like, hey, the way we're doing this industry is dumb. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, especially when you're part of it. If you're on the outside throwing stones, you might be kind of a jerk or a rude commentator. But, like, I mean, I was in the Christian publishing industry for 14 years, and I made as many or more of these jokes when I was in it. I went into marketing meetings with authors, so I was managing a marketing team, talking to my team about how dumb these ideas were. Like this, I may have been in the minority because I know people who drank the Kool-Aid and they were just certain that this was going to be the best seller and the author was going to be so excited about this. And I was like, none of us are excited about this. This is the necessity. When you're part of an industry, your job is to kind of fix it. And if you can't fix it, don't lose sight of where it's ridiculous.
Right. And these are things in which we're both heavily invested. You know, I want to see academia work because I want to keep my job, you know, like I don't want the whole thing to, you know, become obsolete in a few years, even more obsolete than it is currently. And, the book business, we would like to see work because we're in it. But one of the things, Pipe, I want to talk about today is there was this big Penguin Random House thing, and there was all this information and all this data leaked on basically how bad most books do. And you texted a figure last night, and you can fill in the cracks on some of the specifics on this story. And I saw a figure, I ran across the figure a couple days ago, like there are a lot of books that fail to sell even like a dozen copies.
See, I think that's a bad stat. Like, I don't think that's actually real, but there were some others that, based on my observation, I'm like, that seems a lot closer to the truth. And that I texted you.
Yeah, and yours was... Yeah, there are a bunch of books. Like the majority of books never reach 2,000 sales, and 2,000 is kind of the threshold where I don't know. Maybe you can not be embarrassed by it, and you can feel like, okay, so there were some people in the world who weren't like friends and family who bought my book. But most books don't even get there, and it struck me as very interesting that like all these swings get taken in publishing. And all the same authors are doing all the same crap in terms of promotion and self-promotion, but it just doesn't work. Your thoughts on that, dude. Take this wherever you want to take it, because I think it's fascinating.
So Publishers Weekly shared an article yesterday. Yesterday for when we're recording, last week for listeners. Basically kind of breaking down how these statistics get out of whack. And so that's where I got the idea. I'm like, this whole most books don't sell a dozen copies, that's not right. But what they pointed out was that these stats are breaking down every book into every format.
Yeah.
So if there's a hardcover, a paperback, an ebook, like multiple ebooks, some of those formats might only sell a few copies or whatever. And you know, audiobooks don't sell for certain books, etc. So the statistics get skewed. But that stat of 90% not selling 2,000 is, I think that's pretty close to real.
I think it is too.
And having released a book in 2020, which is a terrible time, it was not a good time to release a book because while everybody had more time, nobody was, you know, had the mental capacity to read because we were all freaking out about stuff.
Right.
And it struggled to hit 2,000. I don't even know where it's at now. I haven't really paid that close of attention, but
yeah.
And I'll say, like, as an author, that made me feel really crappy. Like,
Yes.
You know, and selling 2,000 copies is, in my mind, that's a failure.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so,
no, I,
yeah, it just, it
I
doesn't.
Think it is.
And I know you've had some that have done really well and probably all the way down into the sub 2,000 category. And when you look at that, it's just like, oh, why did I bother?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, man. It's interesting you say that. And to your point, like, I've had a lot that have probably been in that sub 2,000 category. And then, like you said, some that have done really well. And at the risk of sounding like too touchy-feely by half here, like, I've almost like closed off that part of my heart, if that makes sense. Like, the part of your heart that cares about how well a book does, like, at some point pretty early in my career, it was probably after Tyson, I did a couple of football books that reviewed really well but didn't sell, and I was really hurt by that. Like, I was really kind of torn up by how those books didn't do well. And I think at that point, I was just like, you know what? That part of my heart, my psyche, whatever you want to call it, is closed, which is good in the sense that I no longer get devastated when books don't sell, but I also no longer get excited about the possibility that they might. And I do miss that. You know, I miss the, like, Kool-Aid drinking, pitch meeting, you know, feeling good, feeling satisfied. You know, I miss that moment. But I don't miss feeling devastated and embarrassed when my book doesn't do well. So I don't know, man. I don't know if I would go back, but I get it. I totally get what you're saying about the sub 2,000 book and feeling like, what's the point? But I would say this to you as a fellow writer, but also someone who admires your work. I read that book and it was really good. And so in that 2000, there are people who needed it. There are people who enjoyed it. There are people whose bookshelf it will live on in perpetuity. And I think you can be satisfied in a job well done. And I know you know all this stuff, but it sort of gets back to, do I love the work or not?
Right.
You know, and if I love the work, then, and if I feel like I did my level best with what I had to work with, then I can feel like I it was a success, you know, and it not be a platitude.
Well, and thank you. What I have learned. So, I mean, I published my first book in 2014, maybe, so 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and have, you know, I've written four and a couple Bible studies since then with varying levels mm-hmm. of success. And I have learned that it is the interactions with people to whom the book meant something.
Yeah.
That are it's the proof in the pudding. Like, it did this book meet a reader in a meaningful way?
Totally.
If so, well worth the time. And if not, well, then I might have wasted my time. But, and I have gotten really encouraging feedback. The failure aspect is a pretty narrow subs. Like, I don't feel like it was a waste of time to write the book or any of the books that have sold well or worse. But taking a step back mm-hmm. and kind of looking at it in the scope of the industry, and I think it's kind of the way you posed the question, like, publishers are throwing stuff against a wall to see what sticks, and kind of being part of that is sort of this feels weird to me, you know?
Yeah.
Because writing, for people who care about it, is an inherently... you're pouring investment into this thing. And I don't want to over romanticize it. You know, there are a lot of people who are like, you cut a vein open and bleed on the page. And I'm like, I mean, some, but mostly it's hard work. And I want to do it well. And I care about the message. Let's just leave it in those categories.
Yeah.
That is not how publishers treat books, because they can't. They know, it's a little bit like if you're a family with 20 kids, you know, you probably have a different relationship with your kids than a family with two or four, you know?
That's true. Yeah.
You can't give them all one-on-one attention and things like that.
Yeah.
And so while there's a creative and industry dissonance between the author, this is my passion project, and the publisher going, I don't know, maybe it'll sell some. essentially approaching it that way.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I don't think there is a way forward out of this. I don't think it's not like there's not a clear path forward to like, oh, let's fix this, because releasing written content has become utterly democratic.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can put out anything anywhere. Anybody can self-publish. I think working with publishers has merit. I still think it's a benefit, but it's not a sales benefit necessarily. Or a financial benefit necessarily, you know, like if you sell 500 self-published copies versus 1500 copies through a publisher, you're going to make more money on those 500. It's just,
It's true. And, you know, I've done that model a few times too through Gut Check, and you're right, you know, and I think doing, you know, Gut Check, having my own little label or whatever, and just doing passion projects over there, there is a sense of satisfaction. And I also think I think you're like me in this. I have a really warm relationship with the books in my life that I like. And I'm talking now as a consumer. So really I own every book I've ever liked, starting from childhood all the way through now. Like, they're on shelves in my office, they're on shelves in my house, they're laying by my bed, you know, they're just kind of everywhere, they're out in my smoke room, like they're literally everywhere in my house, and I think of them warmly, you know. So when I think about putting out a book, either on Gut Check, you know, on Gut Check's label or with a traditional publisher, and I think about it selling 1200 copies, let's say, which we would call a failure, I do think of, well, that's probably going to live in 1200 people's homes, and maybe they'll have a warm relationship with it. You know, maybe, you know, they look at it and they enjoy it and they remember when they read it for the first time or whatever. And it's the sort of romantic part of publishing that I haven't killed in my heart yet, and that I hope I never do. You know, I hope I never lose the romantic, you know, kind of side of it. But Pipe, let's take a break, and I don't want to hear you on that, and I want to ask you some questions about self-promotion, which is kind of how all this started, in terms of our talk about it. Let's take a break. All right, man, we're back. So I have a friend, she's an author, she does fiction, and she's kind of been indicating lately, she's been on this like hamster wheel that all authors are on of like self-promotion and tweeting about it and, you know, sharing images on Instagram of the cover and kind of building this whole world of, I'm this sweet, successful author with a super vibrant life. And, you know, I hear a lot of authors indicate that doesn't work, and I'm really just tired of doing it. You know what I mean? I'm tired of doing image curation via Twitter and Instagram in hopes of selling a book that the publisher's not putting a lot of support behind and that may or may not even sell anyway. And it seems like kind of everybody our age does this, and it's just part of life, but nobody's satisfied with it and it's not working. So what do we do, Pipe?
That is the $64 million question, but since neither of us will ever see a fraction of that, we'll call it the $64 question.
I love it. That sounds more realistic.
Yeah, it's more in line with Christian publishing these days. I don't know, because we had the Happy Rant book come out what feels like 11 years ago when in reality it was about six weeks. I have run out of things to post about it.
Sure.
And that means that as far as, if anybody begins to follow me today, henceforth, they will either have to do a historical dive into my social media accounts, or maybe someday when Harvest House puts it on Kindle sale, I'll share about it again. That kind of, and so it's just like, it is gone. But the alternative is being a pushy, obnoxious, curated, self-promoting blowhard who's like, hey, this book still exists. Hey, I'm super excited about this book. Hey, have you bought this book yet? Hey, this retailer has it on for this sale. Just constantly. And nobody likes that person. Or, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't like that person, which means I don't want to be that person. I was talking to a friend at church yesterday, and we were talking about a whole other area of life. And I was just, I have this kind of hard and fast built-in treat others the way you want to be treated, which means I'm not going to do a thing that annoys me when other people do it, nor am I going to ask somebody to do a thing that annoys me when other people do it. So I can only post about a book in a way that if I saw, let's say, my friend Russ Ramsey, who is an author, pastor, similar walk of life to me, great guy, really good author. If I see him post about a book and it annoys me, I'm not going to do it that way. If I see him post about a book and I think, that's effective. I like that. Yeah. That sounds like Russ. I'm going to do it that way.
Yeah.
So there's sort of the like, I'm going to put myself in his shoes. How would he see this? How do I see it when he does it? Okay. I'm going to try to balance it this way. But the author influencer thing doesn't work. It doesn't work from a sales perspective because there's an inherent difference. I mean, unless you're doing like, I mean, who is I read an article recently and it was, I think it had to do with a musician or maybe it was a TikToker or something, but millions of followers, huge platform. They released a book and it sold like garbage. Why?
Yeah.
Because people who are watching 45 second videos of somebody putting on makeup or being funny or whatever are not interested in spending $29.99 on a hardcover book that requires an actual investment of time.
I know.
It's a different universe. We've almost trained people out of reading. So doing the whole internet influencer thing to sell books is like,
it's such a weird leap. I can't think of any other like industry that would do that.
Well, I can. Like youth ministry does that. You know,
talk about that.
It's like,
in what way?
Come and get like covered in you know, chalk and goo and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to talk about justification by faith alone. You know, like, wait, what just happened here? So,
You're still sweaty from you know, Capture the Flag or Ultimate Frisbee or whatever. But yeah, now sit down and listen to 45 minutes on, you know, Paul's letter to the Galatians, you know?
Yeah. The fact that adults are doing it, and honestly, it probably works better for kids because kids probably have a little bit more mental elasticity to be like,
yeah,
I don't mind sitting here in my own sweat and slime and listening to somebody talk to me about what's meaningful. Whereas adults are like, no, I'm here for mindless entertainment. And now you're asking me to invest money in something that's not mindless and probably less entertaining.
Well, yeah, it's crazy, Pipe. So, yeah, effectively, social media has kind of killed, you know, we've got now almost 20 years of data on this, or 15 years. It's kind of killed reading. It's kind of killed thoughtfulness. It's definitely killed, like, mental quiet. And yet, it's the self-same platform that publishers have been enamored with as a way to sell books. You know, it's ridiculous. Like, it's really a ridiculous leap to make. And what's interesting to me is that when social media first started, I definitely remember publishers being like, oh my gosh, this is so great. Now we've got a direct link to our audiences and we don't have to do in-store signings anymore. We don't have to pay for tours. And we talked about this a couple apps ago, like the old paradigm of like doing radio shows to promo your book has kind of been replaced by podcasts. But like, so this publisher that we're working with now on the Happy Rant book, like they've ostensibly partnered with a PR firm and that's resulted in us doing like 3 podcast appearances in 6 weeks. And I'm like, somebody's losing their shirt on this deal. And that's not a shot at anybody. It's just sort of like
kind of an industry reality. Like it's not.
Yeah. Even that's not working, you know? Because the whole thing about podcasts is, you know, with us being the prime example, it's more fun to just get on and talk about whatever you want than to have some like derpy author on and ask him a bunch of boring questions about his boring book. You know, like, so I don't blame people for not having us on. It's just, it's weird. It's weird to be a part of something that just isn't working and hasn't worked for a long time. You know, how do I end up in these things?
Yeah, it feels like it's like the merry-go-round you can't get off too, because you're like, here we go again. There's going to be some podcast interviews, and like we don't have any idea how many people listen to these podcasts. Like, I know how many people listen to our podcast. Every other podcast is a grand mystery to me, which is part of the social media drug. Is that image project success. And so, I mean, in the same way that people assume that podcasters are rich because, you know, because we have a name that is known, I assure you, we make almost no money off of this podcast, listeners. You know, we joke about it. We are now, you know, with a company that drops in ad breaks every 7 seconds and tries to sell you, you know, Viagra and dog food and, you know, socket wrenches.
But, exactly.
But we don't make that
and
much money.
And we make even
of
less money than we did before, you know, somehow.
Yeah. I mean, it's nobody makes money off this. Nobody makes money off of TikTok, YouTube, whatever. Like, people want to be influencers because they have the impression you make money. Not really. And so it's this. It's that impression that, so like, the publicist is doing her job. She's working hard. She's trying to get us on these shows, whatever. So say we get on these shows. I don't know if 12 people are listening to that. She doesn't know if 12 people are listening to that. And, but there's the impression of we've been on half a dozen shows or 25 shows. I mean, like when I released The Pastor's Kid, I did so many podcast interviews, and that book has sold okay, you know, better than 2,000 by a fair margin, but but it's been out for 8 years. So, you know, I would hope so.
But that one was a great, like, ready-made for podcast type of book. And it dropped at a time when, like, if you were a white dude between the ages of 18 and 60, you had a podcast. That was perfect storm for that. But yeah, even that doesn't translate into sales, you know? So, like, getting excited about spending an hour and a half on some random dude that I don't know's podcast to sell maybe two copies. I would rather spend that hour and a half doing almost anything else.
Here's what I do when I go into those shows. I don't think of it as book promo. I'm just going to have the most entertaining conversation that I can, you know?
There you go.
And because, like, me talking about a book endlessly is less likely to sell a book than me being somebody people enjoy listening to.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true.
So if I can say something helpful, if I can be witty, be whatever, you know, kind of whatever the tone of the podcast is. Like, I was on one for recently that, and they wanted to talk a lot more about, like, they took the little bit out of the Happy Rant book about deconstruction. And that was kind of the whole theme of the conversation. I was like, great. We don't even need to talk about the book. We'll just talk about deconstruction. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about doubt. And then at the end, they kind of wove something back in, and they asked some questions about humor and winsomeness, and that kind of tied the book back in. And I was like, well, 80% of that conversation stands on its own 2 feet. Like, it's just a useful conversation for people who are trying to help, especially like high school and college students deal with faith struggles. I was like, okay, that's a good conversation. Mm-hmm. What I've realized is that, I mean, I made the joke earlier, the only effective marketing strategy is being famous already. Even that has its limitations. There is no effective way to sell books. Yeah. There just isn't. The only effective way to sell books is for them to get into somebody's hand, and for them to there just be sort of less, like, some books catch fire.
Yeah.
And some books, most books, don't. And so it's not social media, it's not advertising, it's not podcasts, it's not any of those things. It's just, if people like it enough to tell their friends and put it in their hands, like, oh, you've got to read this book. When somebody's like, have you, you know, I'm looking for the next book to read, but have you read anything that's interesting? And they're like, yes, you need to read, you know, Beartown by Frederick Bachman or whatever.
Right.
Like, it just rolls off your tongue.
Killer book, by the way.
Yeah, great book. Yeah. Everything he writes is really good. But
definitely.
But the other problem is you can't not do the promotion.
Yeah.
I tried that with one of my books. I didn't get endorsements. I didn't, you know, I would accept podcast stuff, but like there was no advertisements for it. Like it was just pretty minimal.
Yeah.
And it's out of print now. it sold more than 2,000 copies, but it's out of print now. And so I kind of own the rights and have sort of pseudo self-published it, just put it back out there. But you have to play the game to reach the floor.
Yeah.
But playing the game doesn't get you above the floor.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to bring it back around to self-promotion, there are people who really like playing the game. And playing the game brings them a level of satisfaction that I just can't relate to. But I know people like this, dude. I know people who love playing the game, and they love being the author, and they love, like, hey, I got a new book coming out, everybody. You know, I'm super humbled to have this book coming out, meaning I'm super proud of having this book coming out. And, you know, it's ridiculous. And we know that the book won't sell any copies, but maybe their Twitter following doesn't know that. But yeah, it's strange, dude. And I'll say this, and then we'll take a quick break. And I've got one more quick question for you. I always want to feel romantic about it. You know what I mean? Like, the day I don't feel romantic about books, and I don't always feel romantic about it for myself, but I still, in general, have a romantic kind of outlook on books, is the day I need to get out of it. You know what I mean? Like, and I've been close a few times, but I don't know. I still really like them, and I still really hope other people like books. And I think we need them, at the risk of really sounding like a tweed academic douchebag right now. Like, I think we need books now in the kind of electronic world that we live in. They have more value now than they've ever had, you know, as a way to just be quiet, if nothing else. And, I'm here for that.
Well, and I mean, you talked earlier about how social media has killed reading. I think that's true in the sense, like there's sort of a generational sense. There is a generation of people for whom sitting down and reading 3, 4, 5 chapters of a book over the course of an hour or two is foreign. You know,
it's not, or
at least it's not their instinct. It's not their go-to.
Sure.
And, but at the same time, book sales overall are not down. So sales per book, I think, are down significantly in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Total book sales are up. I mean, in part, that's because publishers are cranking out 4 times as many books as they used to or something like that. But
yeah,
like, I'm not worried about the future of books.
Yeah.
But it has become, in the same way that like blogging used to be a thing, that if you started a blog and wrote with any level of adequacy, you would develop a significant following. Now, if you start a blog, like, your mom won't even read it. She's got more interesting things to do. So authoring is a little bit like that right now. But there's going to come another side to this, because there is always value in putting out long thoughts written well.
Yeah.
It is always a benefit to society, to faith, to entertainment, to, you know, imagination, to kind of whatever genre you're in. We need good books. We always need good books.
Yeah.
And so, like, we should always keep putting them out. They're just, we're just in this sort of like purgatory of sales. Like, how do we get them in people's hands? I don't have any idea.
But
we can't not put them out.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and do one more quick thought. All right, Pipe, we're back, and we should wrap this and do a Patreon soon. But my thought, as you were talking about the industry and how it still works in ways in which it doesn't work, I think for pastors and for academics, it still really works as just a resume slapper. You know what I mean? So for a certain kind of pastoral guy, like, having a book is really important to them. So even if the book sells 800 copies, because we all know that it's crappy and flimsy and he's not going to say anything, you know, interesting or important, it's still important for that guy to have a book. You know what I mean? And it's even more so for academics, where the one thing I do appreciate about academia is that, like, most academics go into book publishing like realizing up front no one will read this. And there's this weird sense of, I'm doing this just as a resume slapper, and if anyone reads it, it's a bonus. So I do think the book still, like, serves a very tangible purpose to those two people groups, or just people with egos who want to have a persona and who still kind of are enamored with the whole, like, I'm a writer thing.
Yeah. On principle, I mean, and I realize there's very little that's principled about publishing books, but on principle, I hate books that are written for the author.
Yeah.
I mean, in some sense, all books are written for the author, but like, the author should be seeking to give a gift to a reader, you know, a gift of laughter, a gift of thoughtfulness, a gift of encouragement, a gift of changing perspective, like something of value. And when you're writing it for you, that's called journaling. and keep it to yourself because nobody gives a crap.
Yeah.
Like it's just the sort of this self, which is why most celebrity memoirs are garbage.
Yeah.
Because they're written from the perspective of, I'm so proud of me. Like, well, yeah I'm not. Also not that entertained. Like you are not the gift to me. You needed to do something good in print.
Yeah. Dude, you know what I feel romantic about, which I think we'll never have again? It's the whole, like, reclusive writer persona. And I feel like when I was first getting into writing, like, one of the first authors I ever really loved was J.D. Salinger, who was the, like, recluse's recluse, you know? And so that whole idea of, like, I'm an author, I live in the world of words, I have no interest in promoting, I'm all about the craft, all about the art, like, that persona was really attractive to me. And, you know, lo, these many years later, we're 20 years down the road from, like, when I thought that was super cool. And now, really, being an author is all about the opposite of that. It's all about, like, I set an alarm on my phone so that I can tweet about myself again.
Well,
and it's like,
yeah, and then it's come so, like, bizarrely full circle that there are whole Instagram accounts about, like, reclusive writing retreats.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
exactly,
this little fishing shack in the woods in northern, you know, Alberta. It would be perfect for writing your next great Canadian novel or something like that. You know, like,
right. But, and we've lit it perfectly for all the selfies that you'll take of yourself while you're writing.
How did you get
Canadian
that Restoration
novel.
Hardware chair into that fishing shack? I don't understand.
exactly.
All right. I have one last one more question, and it came up because, and I'm sure you run into this situation. So serving at a church, one of the many things I get to do that I really love doing is just talking to people about whatever's going on in their life.
Yeah.
And I often have conversations with people who are dealing with issues of doubt or issues of sort of dissatisfaction or these different kinds of things. And I've written books on these things.
Yeah.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how douchey is it for me to give them my book to help them with the thing that, like, it's genuinely written to do.
Yeah.
But coming from me, I don't know. I have qualms about this, let's say. So, like, how terrible is it to be like, hey, here's a book for you? Because if I do it, I feel like that scene in What About Bob, where Leo Marvin is like, Bob, there's a book that's recently come out. Let me see. And then he just runs his finger down the shelves upon shelves of his own book and then pulls one out. Ah, here it is.
That's one of my favorite shots in that whole movie is the shot of Dr. Leo Marvin's bookshelf, like, just jam-packed with all of his books. And I get that. Like, that's the best way to describe that feeling. And it's funny, like, when you texted me that question, so I have little piles of my own books in various places in my house. And from time to time, like, this happened Saturday, like, a buddy came over, single guy in his late 30s, came over to smoke a cigar. You know, we were chatting, having a great time. And he's like, oh, is that the new Happy Rant book? And he totally wasn't trying to get a free copy. Like, he wasn't trying to be a chief evangelical. But I was like, oh, yeah, grab one, you know, and it was adjacent to, like, one of the old adoption books or whatever. And I was like, yeah, grab one of those too. So I enjoy doing that. I enjoy, like, sometimes sending people home from my house with a couple of free books that I can tell they're delighted by or interested in, you know, like, wow.
Yep.
You know, I listened to your show, or, you know, we've adopted or whatever. And so I'll always try to send people home with copies of things that I know they'll like, and little kids with a graphic novel. So we'll have, like, little kids come over for small group, and, you know, I'll slide them a graphic novel, which I think is in a different category than what you're describing. But I have done that thing too. And yeah, like, occasionally I'll have, you know, students ask questions about postmodernism or deconstruction or whatever, and I'll slide them a copy of an old book. And yeah, I always feel a little Leo Marvin-y when I do that. And I always caveat it to high heaven, which I'm sure you do too. You do the, like, pathologically Midwestern thing of, hey, I'm not trying to be arrogant here. I'm not trying to be cocky, not trying to have an ego. Like, it's like, I always feel like my dad's watching in those moments.
Yeah, and he would, you end up with, like, here's a book, but feel free to use it as kindling. Like, here's a no book. Problem.
Feel free to, like, run it over with your car and then light it on fire as soon as you get out of the building or whatever. But, and I think that's a moment, though, Pipe, where we can feel appropriately proud of our work, in that, like, hey, it's funny you ask about doubt. I actually wrote 200 pages about that a couple years ago. Here's a copy of the book, you know, and you can feel okay about that. It's not bad. And you're not saying, like, I've written the definitive word on this. But, like, hey, here's a copy. Maybe it'll be helpful. Maybe it won't. But I hope you enjoy it, you know, and I think you can feel okay about that.
I'm trying to think about being on the receiving end of that, because, I have been in and around the sort of authoring game and the church leadership, you know, sphere for so long that it's hard for me to think, like, okay, so I'm a grad student at Vanderbilt and I'm really struggling with direction in life. And I go have a conversation with one of my pastors and they're like, you know, it's a good conversation. And then at the end, they're like, hey, I actually wrote something on this. It might be helpful to you. You know, feel free to read it. It's copies for you. And they just give you the copy. Like, would I feel like it was an assignment? Would I feel like it was a gift? Would I feel like it was self-promotion and this guy was a total tool? Like, I don't have a good sense of how I would receive it. If it was done very just low-key, open-handed, free, obviously. Yeah. I don't know. How do you perceive that? Because that's my question is, am I coming across, if I do this, as a jerk, or am I coming across as somebody who's genuinely helping?
I think it totally depends on the guy. So in the receiving end of that scenario, like, I've had both experiences. Like, I've had the experience where, like, I genuinely like the person and they have a book come out and they give it to me. And I'm just kind of, like, generally happy for them. And I'm like, oh, I'll be delighted to have this on my shelf. Like, I have a section in my, like, personal bookshelf for, like, books by my friends. And, you know, they all kind of go in there and I'm happy about it. And when I walk by it, I feel proud and happy for them. And so that's one category. Another category is the kind of, just the kind of slimy industry, like, hey, here's a copy of my book, you know, subtext. And sometimes people will even say, like, hey, talk about this on your podcast, you know? And I'm like, yeah, sure. I'll get right on that, you know? And like having no intention of ever mentioning it on the podcast. And then there's just kind of a category where, like, some old guy will have, like, I don't know, self-published his historical fiction about World War II or whatever. And I'm just kind of like, ah, you know, that's sweet. Yeah, I'll take it, you know, but I feel no particular obligation to read any of them, but I'd be most likely to read books by my friends who I actually like. Is probably how I would break it.
Yeah, I agree with all of those categories. Anytime I have a friend who releases a book, there is a sense of sort of, you know, rejoicing with those who rejoice when you get that book. You're like, this is exciting. You know, I realize it's not life-changing, but it is, especially if it's their first book, they usually have that sort of, like, super giddy gleam in their eye. Like, this is great. I'm really happy for them. Even if it's, like, their sixth book, you know, still an accomplishment. Yeah. Yeah, it's the giving, the receiving of a book for leverage reasons never goes down well with me.
No. And I'm always a little bit of an a-hole in those moments where I'm like, immediately the warmth that I normally have goes away. Like, the minute I realize we're having, like, an industry interaction, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, my whole, like, probably my body language changes, like, all the warmth that I've been emanating goes away and I'm just like, oh, I see what this is. Yeah, sure. I'll get right on.
Yeah, this was a negotiation, not a conversation. Yeah. I just didn't realize.
Congratulations, buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, And it probably works this way to a sad degree in pastoral ministry too, especially nowadays, where it seems like everybody is leveraging everybody. Like there's a real in me, a real kind of I'm being used here radar. And I don't always reject being used, like, because I assent to the fact that some of that is just part and parcel with the industries that we're in. But I have a much harder time with it when there's like spirituality attached to it, which I feel like is a really gross part of pastoral ministry right now, man. And I would have a really hard time with it if I were in it, just in the sense that, and you live in Nashville. There's a lot of famous people in Nashville. There's a lot of famous ministry people in Nashville. And even just being on the internet, the whole dynamic of like somebody cozying up to you at a conference or even like sliding into your DMs, there for me, there would always be the question of, is this person trying to leverage me? Should I be trying to leverage this person? And then you feel gross and discouraged by the whole thing. Is that something you deal with?
Yeah, but I think my approach to it is a little different just because, I mean, my last name's Piper. People have been trying to get close to my dad by getting close to me since I was like 16. So
that's true. Yeah.
And so the whole like leveraging thing, I have a radar for it. And I'm also just kind of impervious to it in the sense of like, I can just sort of let that roll off. It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't knock me off my game or make me cynical at this point. It doesn't make me more cynical. I'm probably just kind of perpetually low grade cynical because my assumption is somebody's trying to get at somebody because it's Nashville and everybody's everybody's trying to get ahead. But it's it is a real thing though that happens. And you know, at Emmanuel, you know, Ray Ortland started the church and Sam Alberry attends the church and Russell Moore attends the church and I'm on staff at the church. And so like there in our little bubble of the evangelical world, there are names associated with our church and they draw people. People come to, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to hear like, oh, I knew Sam was here. I heard Russell made the move here or I knew you were here. And and I do have to kind of take a step back and go, for whatever reason they walked through the door, the church is the church. And so we need to do what we're doing. And the names play that they don't matter. The name Ray Ortland doesn't matter. Sam Albury doesn't matter. Russell Moore doesn't matter from the perspective of what are we doing here? And so, but it does create a dynamic that we have to be aware of and kind of navigate with probably overly intentional humility.
Yeah, no, that's a good word, man. And that's really interesting. And I think from the layperson's perspective, I'm a layperson who, like, I have a really high view, I think, of pastoral ministry and of the office of pastor. And again, this goes back to, like, probably cockeyed idealism or romantic notions about things that are naive, maybe. But when I see pastors who are so thirsty for the book deal and who are like slobbering all over each other online. And I'm like, guys, get a room, you know, like it makes me feel sad because I feel like that's fine if you're trying to be an actor or you're trying to be a musician or you're holding any of these positions that kind of don't matter and that the Bible doesn't write about. But like, I guess I see pastors in a different light. And when I see them just doing whatever the world does in terms of like slobbering all over each other just to get their next stupid, you know, $5,000 advance for a forgettable book, like I want them to be different. And I'm not sure if that's fair or unfair. Like, is it unfair of me to wish that for pastors? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think it's unfair. And I think I see fewer pastors doing it for the book deal as much as just the like, you know how there's guilt by association? There's also fame by association. Like, absolutely. I want a picture with. There's sort of the like association with this famous person or that famous person. That's one that I have to kind of constantly navigate in the sense of like, I have been around famous evangelicals my entire life. So name dropping, I could win most name dropping contests.
Sure.
Photos with J.I. Packer, mm-hmm. Rick Warren, Beth Moore, John Piper, R.C. Sproul, mm-hmm. whoever, like that. I probably have them somewhere. And, but to what end? Like what?
Yeah.
So yeah, that I think that the sort of the clamoring for fame by association, which can then tie into book deals and book marketing and asking for endorsements and like can become a leveraging thing very easily. All of that is on the table as something that is like, yeah, this, you know, last fall, Beth Moore and Russell Moore did a podcast thing that was hosted at our church. Like we were just kind of the venue for it. Last second, I was asked to kind of MC and host the Q&A part of it. And there's a real sense there of like, I could springboard off of this.
Yeah.
Except that I really like Russell Moore. Like I've known Russell in some capacity for several years and almost never in a public way, just sort of conversations here and there. Members of my family have gotten to know Beth Moore well and really like and respect her. I don't know her well, but like these are people I like. So if that's the case, leveraging this, like it's disingenuous in the human interaction and the respect for kind of who they are, what they're saying, those kinds of things. That's a long rambling answer just to be like, I don't think it's unfair to look at a pastor and go like, stop springboarding. You know, just knock it off.
Just be a little different.
Yeah.
You know, like be different than, you know, the slimy industry person who's just trying to claw their way to nothing. That's true. And it's good. And the internet's made it weird in that, I mean, 30 years ago, if I was a pastor in Indiana, there was no way I could meet Ray Orland. You know what I mean? It wasn't even on the table, and it wasn't even something that I would think about. You know what I mean? If I'm like a small town pastor in Indiana, short of, I don't know, buying a ticket and going to a conference and being one of 8,000 people in the Yum Center, it's just not even on the table. You know what I mean? And that was probably better, because I think like all the delusions of grandeur and all the ideation that these guys do about like, oh, maybe I'll slide into Ray Ortland's DMs and then we can grab a coffee at a conference and then I'll be a, you know, substage D speaker at his next conference, or I'll be a contributor of a chapter to some compilation book. Like those sort of delusions and ideas were not even on the table 30 years ago for most pastors. But I would say they are on the table now for most pastors. And it's rare to run across a guy in pastoral ministry who's of a certain age and who has no interest in it. You know, those guys are unicorns. Yeah.
And the internet skews perception of those guys. Because like you see somebody who's developed a following and they're constantly putting out, I don't know, articles or pithy statements or whatever, and you kind of are under the impression this guy must have a really significant ministry, and then you find out that he's like, you know, the associate worship pastor at a 300 person church in rural Kentucky, and you're like, not that is an insignificant place to serve, but it's clear that his focus is not on serving there, but on blowing this thing out to have a, like his public ministry versus his local ministry are way out of whack with one another.
Well, and even the public quote unquote ministry, how much of it is actual ministry and how much of it is just persona work? Because if I'm spending much time crafting my persona, and for every tweet that's persona related, there's X number of minutes or hours thinking about the persona related tweet. So pretty soon, if I'm stacking a lot of hours doing that, then it follows that I'm not spending a lot of hours doing actual ministry, which kind of calls the whole thing into question. You know, like what percentage of this guy is actually a pastor and what percentage of this guy is actually just a sort of creation, you know, a product. And I guess I just want my pastors to be pastors. And I don't like it when they start being products to a large degree. And I actually think the guys that you've mentioned, I don't know Ray Ortland's work as well, but I really I really respect Sam Alberry's work. But he doesn't seem to me like a guy who's out there being super thirsty for a bunch of retweets and affirmation from the internet, you know? And I like that. You know, I find that easy to respect.
Yeah, he, I mean, what you just described is a, you know, that's what he is not. And then what he is,
right.
I mean, he genuinely enjoys being part of a church and serving a congregation. And he does a lot of public ministry, mm-hmm. but it's actual public ministry. It's going and speaking to and answering questions from and waiting in pretty deep and complicated waters, given that he speaks on a lot of issues of gender and sexuality and like real, real deep things.
Dicey stuff. Yeah.
And he is that way. And it makes it. It's part of the reason why when somebody comes into Emmanuel with an eye on the names, we don't want to turn them away by any means, but we do want to kind of turn their perspective to be like, this is a local church. We serve here. We're members here. We're equals with the other people here in terms of our need for grace and our need for honesty with one another and our need for the gospel. And, you know, we're called to serve, but we're not special. And, you know, Sam embodies that really well. Ray embodied that really well when he was the lead pastor and so forth. But it's, but the perception is a temptation as well. Like, it is easy to be what people perceive you to be.
Yeah, that's right. And it's intoxicating to want to be that. And it provides a distraction from the hard things of life that can even be intoxicating. You know what I mean? It's more fun to do persona work than it is to think about brokenness in my own family or whatever, you know? So I think a lot of people spend a lot of time doing it because it's easy and fun compared to lots of other things. But to your point about Ray and about Sam, like Nashville needs that. Like the Nashville area is kind of filthy with people who want to be somebody. And it's always been that way in the music industry, and I think now it's that way with ministry people. So standing kind of in that world, but sort of against it in the right ways, like that town needs more people like that, just to be examples, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's one of the things that ended up being it kind of folded me into Emmanuel 5 or 6 years ago now, was... because my outside impression was that this is a church of somebody's because I knew Ray's name and I was in the publishing industry. So if you know a name, you assume big ego driven person. I get in the door and realize that's not the case at all. And I think that God has helped us sort of maintain that same level of like, it doesn't really matter what you see from the outside, what you perceive us to be. We are this kind of hopefully normal, accessible church to normal people who aren't looking for platform or ego or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's right, man. And that's good. I think that's an aspirational thing, you know, or it should be for people in ministry. And this has been fun, Pipe. We've been at it for like an hour and 5 minutes now. So
go a lot longer.
We do, don't we? Yeah. You know, Ron's a busy guy. He's always, you know, leaving us to take some other meeting or whatever. But I enjoyed the conversation, man. We have done what we always do on this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout some topics. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks in all circumstances. God invites us to cultivate thankful hearts by turning our eyes toward Him in good times and bad.
To listen to more Abide Christian Meditations, just go to lifeaudio.com or search your favorite podcast app for Abide Christian Meditation. You can also download the Abide app for more biblical meditations at abide.com.